You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
It is 8 days before Thanksgiving. Our pleasure to once again speak with Jennifer Langosch, our Cardinals reporter. And Jen, we thank you for the time here on this Wednesday in November. And Jen, at the risk of asking a really dumb question, somewhere in this vast universe of ours in the last couple of weeks with the World Series, was there at least one Cardinal fan out there that for some reason somehow was actually pulling for the Chicago Cubs in the World Series, or is that completely insane?
Yeah, I mean, I think there were a few. Certainly there's a faction of fans that no matter what will never, ever root against the Chicago Cubs, no matter how much they might be paid to do so. But I think you had other folks here that appreciated the history that's made. I mean, St. Louis, the fan base here, it's a very knowledgeable fan base. They understand history very, very well in this sport. So I think there might have been a little bit of a tinge of appreciation for that from some. But you know what I sensed mostly was a good amount of angst, and not so much that the Cubs were so good this year, but I think a lot of fans in St. Louis who sat down to watch the postseason got a glimpse of how good the Cubs are likely to be moving forward, and kind of that what that presents to the Cardinals in terms of a challenge of closing that gap. So a little bit of nervous energy here, certainly a weird October to not have any baseball going on in St. Louis. But yeah, you probably had a few fans pulling for the Cubs. Probably most would have rather seen the Indians pull that out, however.
Yeah, I would guess that was certainly the case. And not that the rivalry needed any more spice, because it's been so good for so many years. But as you alluded to, now that the shoe is on the other foot and the Cubs are the team that's on top of the mountain, and you know the Cardinals are chasing them, how much more spice could this add to this rivalry?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly a lot. You look at the history of the Cubs and Cardinals, and as good as this rivalry, as you mentioned, has been through the years, it's been very rare for both of these teams to be good at the same time. I mean, usually if the Cubs have had a run, it's come when the Cardinals have had down years and vice versa. Especially in recent history, the Cardinals have been very good and the Cubs not so much. So, you know, the possibility, and we saw it last year when the Cubs and Cardinals met in October for the very first time in franchise history. I mean, the potential for those sorts of postseason meetings, I think, just enhances what is already, it has to be one of the best rivalries in baseball. So, I mean, the Cardinals, they see what's in front of them. Again, I mean, it's no secret they play this team 19 times during the year, and they got to watch them on TV all of October. They see the young talent that Chicago has put together, and it certainly gives the Cardinals motivation to really work this offseason to improve their club. I mean, this is a Cardinals team that finished 17 and a half games behind the Chicago Cubs. So that is quite a large gap to fill. The Cardinals, of course, will remind you that they've kind of been the diamond of the NL Central really since the turn of the century, and they don't think they're going anywhere. But certainly this, I think, has the potential to be a very exciting rivalry moving forward.
Yeah, no question. And even though, as you alluded to, there is a begrudging respect on the part of the Cardinals fan base towards the Cubs, for what they accomplished this year for the first time in 108 years, it's still very difficult to stomach the words, World Series champion Chicago Cubs. So I got to think that the possibility for the Cardinals and their fans to steal Dexter Fowler from the Chicago team, he was so instrumental, not just at the top of that lineup, but defensively in center field. I know there's been a lot of rumors that, you know, he's a free agent again. Return to the Cubs last season. That's probably not going to be the case this year. Cardinals very much in the mix for his services. What are you hearing on that front, and how much of a good fit could he be in that Cardinal lineup?
Yeah, it'd be a little bit of a sweet payback, because you remember a year ago it was Jason Hayward and John Lackey, both players that the Cardinals made qualifying offers to and tried to bring back that ended up going to Chicago. So, you know, of course, the Cardinals would like to lure players back down here. And, yeah, I mean, as you look at Dexter Fowler, there is interest. I will say that he is not the only player the Cardinals are looking at. I mean, this is a very interesting market this winter in that there are not a lot of great options for the Cardinals outfield-wise in the free agent market. So I envision them scouring the trade market very hard for a fit there as well. But, of course, you don't know, A, which players are going to be made available, and, B, what those teams are going to ask for in return. Of course, with Dexter Fowler having just declined the qualifying offer, the Cardinals, if they were to sign him, would lose a first-round draft pick, which is something that they're typically not prone to do, but also, you know, not necessarily counted out from he'd be a good fit in some ways. I think he'd give the Cardinals a new look at leadoff, and this is a guy who is .393 on base percentage over the last 2 years with sixth best in the National League. That would allow the Cardinals to then move Matt Carpenter down into more of a run production spot, and I think that would deepen their lineup in many ways. I think the flip side of it, though, is that the Cardinals really have kind of zeroed in on improving themselves defensively this winter. And when you look at Dexter Fowler defensively, he's not an elite defensive player. He had a good year this year, a lot of that having to do with the way the Cubs positioned him a little bit further back. But over the course of his career, he's actually kind of come in as a below-average defender. So, you know, that might scare the Cardinals away a little bit. I think the interest in Dexter Fowler is going to be very widespread, too, so there's going to be a certain cost associated with that. So, yeah, I could see him as a fit. I'm not sure that he is the best fit, but again, in a very thin free agent market and with questions about who might be available to trade for, he might be the best fit as of right now.
And Jen, you've been writing, again, as you alluded to, that the bigger priority for this Cardinals team where the outfield is concerned is not offensively but defensively. And you've been writing that the Cardinals are entertaining the notion of moving Randall Grichuk out of center field. Is that something that could happen no matter what? And I guess what I mean is, you know, whether or not Fowler joins this team, is Grichuk going to be moved to a corner outfield spot? And if that happens, then who does fill that center field spot if Fowler goes elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, the Cardinals really essentially have two directions to go this offseason. And in a perfect world, if all were to work out as they would like to move Randall Grichuk to left field, of course, taking over for Matt Holliday and Brandon Moss, both of whom are now free agents and unlikely to re-sign. And then the Cardinals could add a center fielder. Again, the priority there being a defensively above-average center fielder. All of a sudden, now your defense, which was really the weakness of this team last year, is that much better. Grichuk played as about an average center fielder. The Cardinals believe if you move him to left field, he is an above-average player. So certainly that is the priority. The fallback option is, and the Cardinals are okay with this, would be leaving Randall Grichuk in center field and then pursuing a left field option. And again, if they can get somebody defensively above average in left field, that would work as well. So they're kind of going attacking this from two different perspectives. Again, in a best-case scenario, they would love to get a center fielder. That's just going to be hard to do. There are not that many available right now, and the ones that might be available via trade are going to cost a lot of money. But outfield certainly is the priority right now, followed by kind of getting some help in the bullpen as well. But really, the Cardinals zeroed in on adding some outfield help.
Yeah, it's just been a strange offseason for the first time in recent memory. It's just a thin free agent class, and you've got big names like a Yoenis Cespedes, but he's never lauded for his defense, even though he's got the great arm. I don't think that's a guy that would be appealing to the Cardinals because for the same reasons you brought up with Fowler, he's not a great defensive center fielder. So there's a lot of odd mixes and matches that teams are going to have to do. The Cardinals are no different. We'll see what the offseason holds. And, Jen, shifting gears, to the rotation, it was such a strange 2016 season for this team, as we discussed at length for 6 months. It was kind of a bizarro world where the pitching did not hold up its end of the deal, but the offense just crushed the baseball all season, something they haven't done in years when it comes to home run power, certainly. So when you look at that rotation, where do their priorities lie and what work is there to be done for John Mozeliak?
Yeah, I mean, the Cardinals really like the options they have within the rotation. And again, I'll take this conversation back to the defensive side of things. I mean, if the Cardinals fielded a better defensive club this year, their pitching would have been better. I mean, there is certainly a correlation there. And you can look at something as simple as, the team ERA ranks 19th in the majors. You look at their fielding independent pitching, which takes out the defense. They ranked 7th in the majors. So, a lot of the issues I think we saw on the rotation side of things, particularly with a guy like Mike Leake or Jaime Garcia, who are very ground ball heavy, were all the issues the Cardinals had fielding the ball cleanly. So, that being said, they are getting Lance Lynn back from Tommy John surgery. And I think perhaps he was maybe not even talked about enough last year about how much the Cardinals missed Lance Lynn. I mean, this is a guy who has become a workhorse in the rotation. He can get you 200 innings very consistently every year. He's going to be back. The Cardinals believe that Adam Wainwright, a year further removed from his Achilles injury, will be better than the version that we saw this year. Mike Leake, as I noted, with an improved defense, should produce better numbers. And then, of course, you have Carlos Martinez, who in many ways emerges the ace of this team. Alex Reyes, Sensational rookie pitcher who came up this year is going to be in that mix. And then you have depth with a Jaime Garcia, whose option was exercised. Michael Wacha, who's trying to come back from a shoulder injury. And then some young lefties in Marco Gonzalez and Tim Cooney. So the Cardinals believe they have a wealth of starting pitchers. And, of course, they need all of them to kind of take a collective step forward in terms of improvement. But again, if you can fortify the defense behind them, I think a lot of that will happen organically.
Yeah, that's a great stat about the fielding independent pitching, seventh in baseball when you factor in the defense, down to 19th. So again, both outfield and infield, you got to get that defense fixed. And that, in turn, is going to make the pitching look a lot better. And I personally cannot wait to see a full season from Alex Reyes. He's going to light up that radar gun for, you know, all things, if all things work out, over 30 starts, and maybe he will be the real breakout star for this Cardinals rotation in 2017. Jen, to begin to wrap up, for the first time in 9 years, Yadier Molina did not win a Gold Glove. That accolade this year goes to Buster Posey of the Giants. I know that Mike Matheny, you know, a former catcher himself, former Gold Glover, his defense of Molina was, well, okay, his defensive metrics were down, no disputing that, but he had a far bigger workload than any catcher in the National League, the numbers by far and away exceeding any other catcher in the NL. From your perspective, did Yadi deserve that ninth Gold Glove, or did the voters get it right this year with Buster Posey?
Yeah, I think the voters got it right. And, you know, I think Yadi's reputation has probably won him this award a few times before. They were, maybe you can make an argument that another catcher was more deserving. I mean, as you noted, I think there were two sides to this argument. The one was that this was a year in which, in many ways, Yadi had the worst defensive year of his career. I mean, he caught stealing only 21% of attempted runners, which was the lowest mark of his career. And after allowing 37 stolen bases 2 years ago, he allowed 67 this year. Now, a lot of that falls on the pitchers not holding runners on, but you know, certainly it didn't help Yadi's credentials. He had a career most 8 pass balls, and he actually finished in the negatives in the defensive run save stat. So in that regard, it was not a banner year. I think you look at the flip side, however, and he started 142 games behind the plate. That's 14 more than any other catcher in baseball. He caught more than 100 innings more than anybody else. And as Mike Matheny kind of stumped for Yadi late in the season, he did hope that that would weigh in voters' mind. And certainly it did, as Yadi was a top 3 finisher behind the plate. But I think when you look at what Buster Posey did defensively across the board, even with a few fewer innings behind the plate, certainly deserving of that award. And knowing Yadi the way I do, I think it's going to serve as a little bit of motivation for him to come back next year and prove that he deserves that award again.
Yeah, nothing wrong with having a little chip on your shoulder to get back to your former heights. We'll see what happens with Yadi in 2017. Jen, final question. We're speaking here 8 days before Thanksgiving. So obviously for Thanksgiving dinner, turkey is always the main attraction. But for you personally, what is your favorite, number one, undisputed, best Thanksgiving fixin'?
Well, I'm going to give you two. For me, it's mashed potatoes and gravy, and it's the Pillsbury Crescent Rolls. But I will tell you, Matt, I'm very excited. For the very first year, my husband and I are hosting both of our families at our new house for Thanksgiving. So I have got to, in the next week, figure out how to cook a turkey, first off. But hopefully all goes smoothly, all the food turns out well, and everybody enjoys themselves. So something that we're looking forward to as a family.
How many people are we talking here?
We're talking about 10.
Okay.
Yeah, it's manageable.
Good. That's great to hear that. And it's a big step to host Thanksgiving dinner, but I'm sure you and the hubby can pull it off. And we wish you and yours a great Thanksgiving. Jen, always a pleasure. We'll do it again at some point soon, perhaps around the winter meetings. We'll see what transpires. Jennifer Langos joining us here on this Wednesday. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, St. Louis Cardinals. It is 8 days and counting until Turkey Day, one of my favorite holidays, and perhaps a favorite holiday of Adam Berry, too. Adam, our Pirates reporter, joining us here once again. And, Adam, it's been a while as we last talked, I believe, on the week leading up to the end of the regular season. And, of course, we're living in a whole new world now where the Chicago Cubs, from the NL Central, of course, are the reigning World Series champions, words we thought we would never hear or utter. But I want to find out from your perspective and from the Pirates fan base perspective. I know that, you know, a lot of fans, when their team is not in it, you kind of hitch your wagon to another team. You kind of pull for a team for whatever reason. So do you feel Pirates fans were rooting for the Cubs somewhat, or is there still that, you know, division rivalry where you don't want to see another division opponent succeed and they were therefore kind of pulling for the Indians?
Yeah, I think it was kind of a weird World Series from the Pittsburgh perspective, because obviously, you know, you don't want to see this, what looks like a Cubs dynasty, kind of come into form. And that, you know, that is obviously the case, and that's what happened, and probably what the Pirates are going to have to deal with in the Central for the next couple of years. But at the same time, there's still kind of a weird anti-Cleveland thing in Pittsburgh, you know, kind of the Rust Belt competitors, the old, you know, Brown Steelers thing. So I guess more people probably sided with Cleveland than the Cubs, just because of what the Cubs kind of represent for the Pirates. Not only the last couple of years with the wild card game last year, but then, you know, going forward, it could be pretty tough competition for the Pirates.
Yeah, that's a good point, that this does not appear to be a, you know, one-and-done thing with the Cubs. They have so much young talent, and they're so good, and they're on top of the mountain right now, so it could be an uphill battle for not just the Pirates, but the other three teams besides the Cubs in the NL Central for years to come. Adam, were you at the World Series? And if not, you know, when people who don't work in baseball ask me about Game 7, I say that in my lifetime, it's easily maybe one of the top two or three games that's ever taken place again in my life. What about yours?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's probably maybe the best game as far as significance and the actual dramatics of it. You got the rain delay there at the very end and how much that added to just sort of the lore of the whole thing, you know, that neither team could possibly win a World Series. I think it's probably the most dramatic, biggest game that I've seen that's happened in my lifetime. But I can tell you that a lot of people around here would disagree with it as far as being the best Game 7 of all time, because there is a guy named Bill Mazeroski who hit a pretty big home run for the Pirates in Game 7 of the World Series. Still the only walk-off home run in World Series Game 7 history. So I'm just going to throw that out there.
Yeah, and that's amazing because Joe Carter's in 93. That was Game 6, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Mazeroski in Game 7, 1960, to beat the Yankees, no less. That is a moment that's going to be tough to top, not just for baseball, but for the Pirates, too. So, yeah, a lot of good games in that span. 91, Game 7 between Jack Morris and John Smoltz is up there, too. You can't discount that. But this Game 7 between the Cubs and Indians, pretty epic indeed. Adam, getting back to the business at hand with the Pirates and their offseason, I know that something we discussed at length was that this rotation had a complete makeover from Game 1 to Game 162. When you look at kind of the guys that seem to be shoe-ins for the 2017 rotation, you're talking Jameson Taillon, you're talking Gerrit Cole. Outside of that, and you throw in Ivan Nova, who was so great, but he's a free agent, how do you see the Pirates, you know, rebuilding and fortifying this rotation for 2017?
Yeah, I think you're right that Gerrit Cole and Jameson Taillon are the shoe-ins. You'll see them number one and two. And that's a pretty good top of the rotation, I think, for any team. It's something that the Pirates can count on for the next couple of years. I think you'll see Chad Kuhl, who showed some pretty good signs in his rookie season. You'll see him somewhere at the back of the rotation. The Pirates love those pitchers who can, you know, throw ground balls, and that is very much Chad Kuhl's strength. I think you'll see one spot made up of another young pitcher, whether it's, you know, Tyler Glasnow, Trevor Williams, Stephen Brault, Drew Hutchison, one of those guys seems like kind of a lock for that fourth spot. But they still need somebody for that third spot in the rotation, and it's not going to come easy because this is a really brutal market as far as free agents go for starting pitching. And they could use an advantage there. It's something they had, you know, in the previous couple of years with guys like A.J. Burnett, Francisco Liriano to a certain extent, Edinson Volquez, and then Jay Happ at the end of 2015. So they need to fill that third spot in the rotations, kind of a void right now. A lot of people basically feel like that's going to determine, you know, whether their offseason is a success or not and whether or not they're a contender come 2017, because if the rotation goes, you know, too deep with some question marks at the back end, that's a whole different ballgame than if you're talking about three solid, you know, dependable guys who give you a chance to win every single time out. So I think Nova is an option. The recent report, I think his agent said on MLB Network Radio that they've received offers in the three-year, $36 million range. It's probably an encouraging sign for the Pirates because they gave a little bit more than that to Francisco Liriano a couple of years ago. So I think until they're officially declared out of that market, you have to at least consider them in.
Yeah, that's a good point that they gave more money to Liriano, and it's a small sample size, but Nova so far in his tenure with the Pirates has been a more accomplished pitcher than Liriano was, certainly when he was with the Pirates last year prior to the trade with Toronto. So as you said, Adam, given the fact that the pitching, the starting pitching market is very thin in free agency this year, does that inspire the Pirates a little bit more to perhaps overpay slightly for a guy that, let's face it, is a number three starter, and that could, you know, that could work in Nova's favor? But do you think the Pirates would maybe bite the bullet here a little bit and say, you know what, there's not a lot of options out there. This is a guy we really need.
Yeah, I don't think it's really within their system to overpay, to make an emotional kind of decision. So I wouldn't expect them to overpay, especially in terms of dollars and years. The last thing they really need is a contract that's going to hamper them into the future. You saw the only way they really have with their lower payroll, the only way out of that is a trade like the Francisco Liriano deal, which is not something they can really afford to do a ton of in the future, you know, parting ways with pretty good prospects just basically to unload a salary. I think, you know, you could see then maybe do they turn to the trade market, but it's pretty well documented that in a thin free agent market, the price for trades is also going to rise a little bit, and I don't think they want to part with any of their top prospects, you know, guys like Austin Meadows or even a Josh Bell or Kevin Newman, Mitch Keller, to get a starting pitcher for really the need is 1 or 2 years. So it's kind of a tough market for them to be, you know, needing a starter. It's a situation where you'd feel a lot more comfortable if you had, honestly, a Francisco Liriano still under contract, because if you look at what they might be searching for in this market, it'd probably be, you know, a short-term deal for a veteran, proven to be able to pitch some innings, you know, with some upside. And really that is Francisco Liriano under contract for 2 years and $26 million, shown kind of number one, number two upside with the ability to pitch 170, 180 innings. So it is a little bit ironic when you look at it, you know, that that's basically the guy they just traded away because they thought he, you know, wasn't going to be effective going forward in the National League. But that is kind of the model, I think, that you'd look for as far as what they're searching for this offseason.
Yeah, it's a balancing act for sure between you know, the years, the money, and the prospects that you know may give up or not want to give up in the trade market at least. But we'll see what happens. I think, like you said, it's encouraging that at the end of the season, I think most Pirates fans were resigned to the fact that Nova's a goner. But now, when you hear what his agent's saying about, you know, the neighborhood of 3-36, that's something the Pirates could do, and maybe he is a full-time guy in that rotation in 2017. We will find out. Adam, to begin to wrap up here, you know, just want to get your thoughts on Andrew McCutchen. To me, it's remarkable that in a span of 12 months, this guy goes from the undisputed, unmistakable face of this franchise, a former MVP, the, you know, the absolute, like I said, the central piece of this Pirates team, to a guy that many fans are saying, you know what? What can we get for Andrew McCutchen? It's incredible to me. Yes, he had a down season in 2016, but he's human. He's still Andrew McCutchen. What are your thoughts on this entire thing, the attitude towards McCutchen, and whether or not he's going to be back with this team in 2017? That's a statement that at one time seemed unthinkable.
Yeah, it's so bizarre how quickly this turned, really, just because he had, you know, a bad 4 months. You look at it, he was fine in August and September. The defensive numbers probably are a little bit more concerning because he doesn't look like a guy, based on those metrics and the ascension of Starling Marte, that you want to have in center field next season. So that adds kind of a whole different wrinkle to this conversation. But yeah, I don't think the Pirates are looking to shop Andrew McCutchen. In fact, I know they're not shopping him, as in trying to get rid of him, but they're going to listen. And that's kind of, you know, that's something they might have had to do even if he was coming off of a good year, if not even more so if he was coming off of a good year, because when you're sort of a team that has to survive on a smaller payroll, you know, that's how you capitalize on assets, is flipping them when they're, you know, nearing the end of their contracts, coming off of, you know, at the peak of their trade value. And that's not the case with McCutchen right now, which is why I don't think you're going to see him dealt this offseason. I think the Pirates are going to find that they have a different assessment of McCutchen's value than other clubs might, because, you know, they still view him as a guy who will bounce back and be, once again, an MVP type player, and I don't know if other clubs are going to see him that way when they look at the performance that he's coming off of overall in 2016. But it's definitely an interesting thing to keep an eye on this offseason. It's probably the story of the Pirates offseason, whether or not he's available in the trade, just how available he is, you know, what the Pirates could get back, because there is the argument that if you could get that number three starter for McCutchen, A number two, number three type, you could technically get by without him. You could put Starling Marte in center, move Gregory Polanco to left or keep him in right and find a short-term solution in the other outfield corner until top prospect Austin Meadows is ready. So there's really a lot at play in the Andrew McCutchen conversation right now, but overall it is kind of hard to believe that, I think when I probably first started doing this podcast, we were talking about making McCutchen a Pirate for life. With a lifetime contract extension, and now here we are, November, and we're talking about a potential McCutchen trade.
It's unreal. I mean, it just goes to show what a brutal sports and business this is. That one down year, and suddenly here come the vultures, and they want to see what they can get in return for you. They want to send you elsewhere, see you in another uniform, and it's very much a what have you done for me lately industry, as we're finding out the hard way, the harsh way. As far as Andrew McCutchen, and Adam, like you said, something to keep an eye on during the next couple months leading up to 2017 for sure. Adam, I don't know if we'll speak again before Thanksgiving, as today is November 16th. So outside of turkey, which is always the main attraction, what is your favorite Thanksgiving fixin', I guess?
Oh, man. My in-laws make a really good green bean casserole. I know that's probably a really unpopular pick, but my wife's mother makes a really good green bean casserole. That is always a highlight of our trip down there. And we're actually not going back down to Florida this year, so we're going to try to recreate it up here in Pittsburgh. So that'll be interesting.
Yeah, tall task. It's tough to duplicate, the efforts of the in-laws for the holidays where the food is concerned, but I wish you luck, and I wish you and your family and your friends a great Thanksgiving. Adam, thanks for the time. We'll do it again soon. Thanks a bunch.
All right, thank you.
All right, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Pittsburgh Pirates. We are talking Brewers baseball today, just 8 days from Thanksgiving. That is hard to believe. Where does the time go? Adam McKelvey joins us on this Wednesday. Adam, thank you so much for the time. And Adam, when we last spoke, the Chicago Cubs had a 108-year title drought. That is no longer the case. Coming off an epic 7-game fall classic, the Cubs, they're off the boat. They win it for the first time since 1908. And Adam, what I want to find out from you, kind of the pulse of the Brewer fan base in terms of, I kind of find that as a fan, when your team is not in it, you pick a team to root for whatever reason you may have. So from the Brewers fans' perspective, because the Cubs are a division foe, do they root against the Cubs, or do they say, we've got nothing against them? I don't think they're really rivals in the traditional sense. So did fans kind of say we'd love to see this for them and their fan base to end this epic drought? How do you think Brewers fans felt about the Cubs of finally winning it all?
Well, I think it's a mix, like anything. But I would, if I had to guess, if we put this up as a poll, I think the majority would not have been rooting for the Cubs. And it's, it's a division rival. It's a lot of fans here get irritated when Chicago fans come up to games at Miller Park and kind of tend to take over Miller Park a little bit. So I don't think there's a lot of love between the franchises. I mean, for me, it was cool to be there just from a baseball history point of view. Helping out covering for MLB.com, just to be in the building for that game 7 was pretty amazing. So I think there's a respect for what they were able to accomplish, but I don't think the majority of Brewers fans were jumping up and down when they got that final out.
Yeah, that would seem to be the case, based on the pulse of the fan base. And like you said, when the Cubs come to town, here comes Cub Nation, who try to take over Miller Park, and that cannot be too kind. For the Brewers fans that do go to those games. But, Adam, like you said, you were in the building, Progressive Field, for Game 7. In my lifetime, I think the only game that can rival that one would be Game 7 of 91 between the Braves and the Twins, Jack Morris and John Smoltz. That was epic. This was epic. As I'm watching the game on TV, when Rajay Davis hit the homer to tie it, I'm thinking, they got it. This curse is going to continue for the Cubs. They blow a 6-3 lead. It's 6-6 now. Was that kind of how you felt at that time?
Oh, the momentum swung unbelievably. And I had two post-game assignments that day that I really loved. One of them was the guy who got the final out for the Cubs, Mike Montgomery, and Carl Edwards Jr., who weren't exactly the names you expected at the start of the season to seal the Cubs, the end of the Cubs title drought. The other story was the rain delay. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people have heard that story by now. Jason Hayward called the Cubs into the weight room, and they had a little team meeting, and they reset themselves a little bit after the disappointment of that Davis homer. And there was a wide consensus that that rain delay really was a big deal in terms of the way that game ended. It allowed the Cubs to kind of hit the reset button, came out, you know, as they put it, I think it was Jed Hoyer told me, their outlook was all we have to do now is win one inning. And they did, and they're world champs because of it. So it was an incredible moment when he pulls that homer. And again, just to be there and out in the auxiliary press box, I was really happy to be out there instead of in the main box, because you're sort of out there with the fans, and there were a ton of Chicago fans there. So it was a really memorable, you know, no matter who you're rooting for, just in terms of baseball history. You know, I put this out there that night. I think you can make an argument, given the context for both franchises, that that was the best game in the history of baseball. And I know there have been better individual performances and better games, and you mentioned one of them that you could put up there, the Morris-Smoltz game. But, I mean, just in terms of 108 years and 78 years of the long droughts, the way that game twisted and turned, the rain coming, I mean, that was an unbelievable baseball game. Just, you know, again, Brewers fans – a lot of them weren't thrilled with the outcome, but it sure was fun to watch.
It really was. And like you said, given the circumstances and the context, I would agree with you that you can make a very strong case that that was the greatest baseball game ever played. The two teams with the two longest active droughts going head-to-head in a Game 7. You've got a leadoff home run, for crying out loud, on the fourth pitch of the game. You've got the home team battling back from, I believe it was 5-1 at one point, then 6-3, extra innings. The rain, the speech, you can't put the stuff in a movie and make it believable. That's how epic it was. So hats off to the Cubs. As much as Brewers fans don't want to hear that, they are the 2016 World Series champions. And, Adam, I know that's a memory that you'll cherish for the rest of your life, to be there on the scene at Game 7. And I'm getting back to what the Brewers are doing here in the 2016 offseason. I think it's doubtful that many fans are familiar with the name Paulo Espino, but that's someone you wrote about recently. He's a 30-year-old career minor leaguer, 7 years in the farms, I believe, and the Brewers just signed him. When you look at his age, his pedigree, and his circumstances, it sounds a lot to me like Junior Guerra. Again, Espino was 30. Guerra was 31 at the start of this past season. The Brewers take a flyer on him. Look what happens. He produces, has a great 2016. Do you see some similarities between the two, and is Guerra the reason that the Brewers said, you know what, let's see if lightning can strike twice with Paulo Espino?
Well, you know, I don't know. The circumstances are similar, very different guys. You know, Junior Guerra has that 96 and that great splitter. I don't know that Espino has that sort of an arsenal, but it just in the more general sense, I think it's a reminder that pitching comes from everywhere. And you don't know which guy is going to come in and play a role for you and which guy is going to be a late bloomer. The thing this guy has going for him, when you look at his numbers, is you need to hit your way on against him. He does not walk anybody. And I think that's one of the strengths that Junior Guerra had going for him as well as he developed and gained the Brewers' notice, is he was another guy who didn't give up free base runners. I think that is one of the traits, as we sort of learn more about David Stearns and Matt Arnold in this Brewers front office, that's obviously one of the traits that they are valuing pretty highly among their pitchers. So this is a guy, you know, if you think back to Junior Guerra last year, he came into spring training, he competed for a job in the bullpen, he went to AAA to start, and then he ended up being promoted in May when the Brewers had a need. You could see this guy, Espino, taking the same sort of a path. He's a guy, unlike Guerra, who's not on a 40-man roster, so he's going to have to do it as a non-roster invitee a little different. But, I mean, stranger things have happened in baseball that, you know, this guy will have an opportunity to contribute at some point. And you mentioned his long road. He's had 10 years in the minor leagues, parts of 7 seasons at AAA. You do not see that very often. So he has been right on the cusp of the major leagues for a very long time. And obviously he hopes that this is the year he finally breaks through.
Yeah, I give him credit for sticking with it. You know, a decade in the minors, 7 of which at AAA, that's got to be more frustrating than being at a lower level because you are so close and you just can't break through. But for his sake and hopefully for the Brewers, this is another diamond in the rough. and he finds his way to the big leagues in 2017. Adam, speaking of Junior Guerra himself, what do you think the team does with him? We've mentioned, you know, he had great numbers this year, but, you know, he is 31. Is he a guy that, you know, you make a mainstay in that rotation, or is he a guy coming off a career year that you perhaps sell high upon?
Well, we'll see. You know, and I don't know the answer to that. There's a case to be made both directions. The case for keeping him is that he was their best. He was their pitching MVP last year. He has 5 years of club control. Yeah, he's 31, but he has taken such a strange path through professional baseball that he's not a guy who's logged a ton of innings. So he has maybe a younger arm than your typical 31-year-old who has stayed stateside the whole time. And you need good, you know, you still need good players. Even if you're a rebuilding team, you still need guys who can perform. And he showed throughout the course of last season that he was able to perform. The case for trading him, though, is that you are in a position as an organization where you have already traded away a ton of your established assets for prospects. And there's a case to be made that you just go all in that direction and you just go for it. You trade everybody you can trade, get as many prospects as you can, and build that farm system. And I think that Guerra's a guy that when you look at, number one, this market in baseball and how weak, relatively weak the free agent market is, with due respect to all the players who are out there, Rich Hill and company, I think there's, you know, Junior Guerra has some value when you look at what else is out there and the number of teams that will be looking at starting pitching. And then you look at the Brewers roster as it stands right now. I mean, they've got six big league starters for five spots. And that's not including a guy like Taylor Youngman, who's a former number one pick, who's going to try to get his way back into that mix. And then Josh Hader, their top prospect, who finished last year at AAA, so that puts him kind of on the cusp of the big leagues. And if you follow the last 3-4 years of the Brewers, they've had a guy in that position, and by some point in the middle of the next season, he ends up in the major leagues. So I think that they're a team that, despite being in rebuild mode, despite coming off a fourth-place finish, they're actually reasonably deep in starting pitching, so it makes a guy like Guerra available. And certainly some of the other pitchers, starting pitchers that they have. Chase Anderson, for example, I think could be had on the market. And, you know, even if some team wants to take a flyer on a guy like Willie Peralta, last year's opening day starter for Milwaukee, David Stearns has a number of different options in terms of listening on offers from other clubs. And he says he's had discussions with other clubs. So I think there are some avenues that he can pursue there as they continue to just pile up as many prospects as they can.
Some interesting decisions lay ahead in the coming weeks and months for sure for David Stearns. And Adam, to wrap up here, Craig Counsell was recently rewarded with a 3-year extension. And, you know, maybe outsiders look at Counsell in his first full season in Milwaukee, 16 games under 500. They kind of say, well, you know, why an extension now? But explain why he is held in such high regard by this franchise.
Well, number one, they were better last year than I think almost anybody expected. They had some breakthrough performances from some young players. Jonathan Villar stands at the top of that list, and Craig Counsell deserves some credit for the development of some of those players. And again, the bigger picture here is he's just the guy for this job. I think there's a wide consensus inside the front office among the fans that I hear from that you're not going to find a guy better suited for this role. This is a guy who grew up in this city. You know, he grew up around the great Brewers teams because his father worked in the front office. He won a couple of world championships. He wore the uniform as a player in Milwaukee. He's got the respect of these players because of all the things he's done. He's open to the analytical approach of this front office, yet he still has that hard-nosed reputation. He's just got this mix that made the announcement that they had extended him probably the least surprising news. And in fact, David Stearns called it the easiest decision he's made in his year plus as Brewers manager. It was just a matter of coming up with a deal that everybody could agree with. That deal, by the way, ended up being 3 years. So he's now through 2020. And it's, you know, the caution from David Stearns all along has been, you know, don't put a timeline on us. They're not thinking in terms of a firm timeline, but this now, I think it's in the minds of fans a little bit, is, okay, this is kind of a window now to do something. And as Craig Counsell said, he is really excited about the prospect of bringing this team back into postseason contention, the prospect of playing October games at Miller Park. And the way he said it is he views this as an opportunity or a little certainty that he's going to get to see that project through. Now, the big challenge is there's some other really good teams in this division, starting with the team we began speaking about, the Chicago Cubs, who are also really young. They look like they're going to be good for a really, really long time. And that's going to be the big challenge for this Brewers team now is can you compete in a division that has a really elite team? Some would argue the best team in baseball. And they're going to have to contend with that for a number of years. Council was asked about that at his press conference. And his take, he's spinning it as a good thing, that he says as they develop, as they rebuild, they're going to have to play against this level of competition. He thinks that's going to make the players that they're developing better. So we'll see. It's certainly a tall task, but now he has a little bit of certainty that he's going to have an opportunity to see it all the way through.
Yeah, and no better guy to have at the helm to face those challenges, as you outlined, than Craig Counsell, of course. And Adam, before I let you go, we're speaking here 8 days before Thanksgiving, so I want you to reveal to the world, outside of turkey, which is the main attraction, what is Adam McKelvey's favorite Thanksgiving fixin'?
You know, the turkey for me is the highlight.
Of course.
I have always, though, been a green bean guy.
Okay.
The green beans with the fried onions on top,
yes,
that everybody has,
yes,
with the cream of mushroom soup. And then there's this other one that's always on my family's table that's like green beans with like some lemon on it, more like fresh green beans with lemon and some almonds. It's really simple but really delicious.
Wow.
It's the lamest answer for a Thanksgiving thing when everybody else is saying mashed potatoes and pie. But to be honest, that is usually the first thing I go for is a green bean.
Your colleague Mark Sheldon from the Reds said his wife whips up some mashed potatoes, which are to die for. So we've had a few different responses, but nothing wrong with green beans. I'm a green bean guy, and they're always on my plate and in my stomach at Thanksgiving. So I definitely see you on that one. And Adam, I wish you and yours a great Thanksgiving this year, and we will talk again sometime, I think, around the winter meetings in December. The time is flying by pretty quick. Adam McKelvey joining us here on this Wednesday. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Milwaukee Brewers. It is 8 days before Thanksgiving. Where does the time go? We welcome back in Mark Sheldon, our Reds reporter. And, Mark, thank you for the time, as we've all had a chance to kind of catch our breath following a whirlwind regular season and the postseason, of course, which saw the Chicago Cubs, and I still can't believe I'm uttering these words, winning the World Series, but yes, it did happen. And Mark, I want to find out, you know, from your perspective and from the perspective of the Reds fan base, you know, when your team is not in it, I know a lot of fans kind of hitch their wagon to another team that is in it, and you root for them for whatever reason. I know that, you know, the Cubs, obviously a division rival, but how do you think Reds fans felt towards the Cubs? Did they pull for them because they are in the same division? Or is it, you know what, they're a division foe, I don't want them anywhere near a World Series title, and, you know, go Cleveland, obviously the Ohio connection there. How do you think Reds fans felt about that World Series?
I think a lot of them might have been more interested in what the Cincinnati Bengals were doing on the football field. But I would say that in terms of baseball, I can see that because of the geographical situation, it's really only an hour longer to Chicago than it is to Cleveland. I think there were some fans that were definitely, you know, around here that were pulling for the Cubs just because of the long history, the 108 years, just wanting to get that over with. But at the same time, there's a lot of fans here and a lot of homes here that have, you know, Indians and Reds fans in it. And I could see some spouses, pulling together for their loved one to see their loved one be happy and have an Indians win in the World Series. So I think there's a few different people. I think as far as the players were concerned, I think if they're not in it, they don't care. They're not going to pull for a team, especially one that they do play a lot. I think it'd be tough for any Reds player to sit there and say they were rooting for anyone to win a World Series. I don't think they're as affected by things like curses and long droughts. So I think the only drought they want to end is the Reds drought. They have not won a World Series now or been to a World Series since 1990.
Yeah, which seems like child's play compared to the droughts that the Indians and Cubs were facing a couple of weeks ago. The Indians now have that scarlet letter on their chest. They now have the longest drought since 1948, and the Cubs are off that island happily for them. But, yeah, interesting dynamic given the geography and given the, you know, the division alignments where Reds fans' loyalties lie. It was, I think we can all agree, an epic seven-game fall classic. And again, the Cubs rule the roost here as we head into 2017. And Mark, getting back to the business at hand about this Reds team for 2017, as you wrote, it always seems like there's annual speculation this time of year. It's a tradition. Joey Votto, does he stay? Does he go? And I know that you can apply that to some other veterans on this team, Brandon Phillips in particular, Zach Cozart too. So when you look at those three guys, who do you see remaining in Cincinnati? Who do you see as a potential trade candidate? How do you see that whole thing shaking out between those three?
Well, I think of the three, Cozart is the most vulnerable to being traded, only because he has no contractual leverage. He's a year from free agency. He's heading into his third year of arbitration. He's coveted. I think, you know, teams like the Mariners, who need a shortstop, seem to be a fit. At the same time, they also need to find a place for Jose Peraza to play. And I think you put all that together, and he seems to be a possibility. When you look at Brandon Phillips, he has the no trade protection, which he used last year to block a trade to the Nationals. But again, the Reds need a place to play Jose Peraza and maybe Dilson Herrera. And you also look at that, he's got a $14 million contract, and he's a year away from being a free agent as well. I could see him being moved if he's willing to accept it. I think, you know, just talking to a source, the circumstances are far different maybe this year than they were last year. I think last year they felt like they might be able to extract an extension or some more money. It didn't happen. And I think going into the final year of a contract, being almost 36 years old, wanting to win a champion. He told me in September he wanted to win a championship. So that's not going to happen probably in 2017 in Cincinnati. So he might want to look somewhere else. And, of course, Joey Votto, it's become a kind of a parlor game to see if he would ever accept a trade or if the Reds would ever be willing to trade him. I know I get a call about once or twice a year from a radio station in Toronto asking me about the possibility, and I would say that's probably highly unlikely. GM Dick Williams told John Morosi from MLB Network last week during the GM meetings that there was no interest in moving Votto, that they really want to see him be here for the completion of the rebuild. And I just know from my own experience of talking to him last year, he didn't want to be traded. He wants to be a Red for the rest of this contract. He's got 7 years and $179 million left on it. It's a lot of money, of course, but he seems to be wanting to be here for the whole thing and finish his career as a Red. So I'll never say never, but I don't see him being traded.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, going back to Brandon Phillips, in that, if I heard you correctly, he blocked a trade or did not accept a trade, a proposed trade, from the Reds to the Nationals this past season. The Nationals obviously were in the playoffs. They're in the mix every year as a postseason team. And then he turns around and says, well, I want to play for a champion. I want to win a championship before I retire. So those two things don't quite equate, do they?
No, they don't. I mean, this is about a year ago in December that the deal was proposed. Maybe things have changed. I think going through another season, of over 90 losses might have changed his perspective, perhaps. I don't know. Obviously, the Nationals did okay. They went out and got Daniel Murphy, and the rest is history for them. But the issue for Phillips is, even if he was willing to be traded this year, the market's a lot different this year. You know, Neil Walker accepting the qualifying offer to the Mets has already eliminated one team that might need a second baseman. The Angels and Dodgers kind of look like they might need a second baseman, but there's really not a huge demand for second baseman, especially veteran 35-year-old second baseman making $14 million. So although Phillips had a nice year offensively, it wasn't great as far as the power goes, but he did hit about, I think, 12 homers, and he got a lot of hits. He wasn't really a great on-base guy, and his defense is not as good as it used to be. He has a negative WAR on defense, but I think his market could be affected by just the fact that there really isn't a lot of demand. But we'll see what happens. I wouldn't be shocked if all three of these guys end up being on the opening day roster, because the Reds don't like, you know, a deal they get for even for Cozart. They can keep him and hold on to him and Phillips for that matter, and see what happens at the trade deadline.
Yeah, I mean, deal from a position of strength, obviously, if you can, and, you know, don't do something reckless when you can hang on to guys, like you said, and maybe do something at the trade deadline leading up, you know, this for the 2017 season and get something back of bigger value than you could potentially get now. So we'll see what the Reds do there. And, Mark, to shift gears a little bit, you wrote about the upcoming Rule 5 draft and some of the tough decisions that the Reds are going to have to make with regards to that draft. And I know that even the most diehard baseball fans are not quite entirely familiar with the machinations of the Rule 5 draft. So kind of break that down for us and explain, you know, how that incorporates to the tough decisions that the Reds are going to have to make regarding it.
Well, as well, we're talking on a Wednesday, and by Friday, the Reds will have to make a decision of who they're going to protect on their 40-man roster. Players that are left off the 40-man roster that were drafted as an 18-year-old in 2012 or as a 19-year-old or older in 2013 are eligible to be plucked from the Rule 5. And the Reds have 33 men on their roster right now, so that means seven openings. They have a lot more than seven players that maybe they would want to protect in this situation. If, you know, the Stone Cold Blocks look like guys like Jesse Winker, their number three prospect. But then you kind of go down, and there's a lot of top 30 prospects in there, whether it's Colton Dahl or Aristides Aquino or Eric Jagielo, Kiery Mela, Nick Travieso. These are all top 30 guys. And then even outside the top 30, you have guys that they have at the Arizona Fall League, like, you know, Brandon Dixon, Chad Wallach, Barrett Aston, and Zach Vincege. And it's just a lot of names out there. I'm not sure that any of these guys are coveted necessarily by other clubs. I mean, last year the Reds had nobody taken off their roster or off their organization from the Rule 5. But I would say this year they're a little bit stronger in their system. They had a nice draft. They've been really doing well with the rebuild. They've added a lot of players from, you know, through their trades. So the Rule 5 situation might be a little more different for them this year. They just definitely have a lot more youth in their system, and maybe more youth that's attracted for other clubs to maybe take a run at.
Yeah, I mean, it's always, like you said, maybe the guys that you don't protect aren't necessarily coveted, but then you've got guys in recent years like Justin Bour, Delino DeShields for the Rangers, and going back a few years before that, I believe Dan Uggla was also a Rule 5 guy. So you've got guys that do kind of slip through the cracks, and they're picked up by other teams, and you never know what could happen. It's always an anxious time for GMs when this rolls around. And like you said, we're talking here on a Wednesday. The deadline is Friday to determine who you protect and leave unprotected for the upcoming Rule 5 draft. And, Mark, to begin to wrap up here, I have to admit I was rather surprised going back to the Gold Glove announcements last week that Billy Hamilton did not win. I thought he was going to be a lock for center field. That award went to Ender Inciarte of the Braves, who himself had a great year. The defense of Inciarte that I hear from people is, you know, while Hamilton may be flashier, Inciarte overall better. What's your perspective on that?
I think, if I'm not mistaken, Hamilton may have had some better defensive metrics on the advanced stat side. I think Inciarte had more assists and some of the more traditional numbers, I think, were hit to his benefit. I think really when it comes down to is Billy Hamilton missed the final month of the season. He didn't take another at-bat after September 4th. He didn't play the field, obviously, either. And when managers and coaches start voting, it's usually about 2 or 3 weeks into September, right before the end of the season. And I think that probably hurt him. I think it's just one of those things. If he wasn't playing, maybe he wasn't fresh enough on their mind. And I take nothing away from Inciarte. I thought he might win, too. I thought it was a chance that either one of those guys could win. I wasn't shocked, especially when you look at the lack of games that Hamilton had in comparison. But I would say either one of those guys was definitely worthy of a Gold Glove. I know Hamilton's probably getting a little frustrated. This is his third time as a finalist, and he still has not come away with the award yet. I got to imagine there's going to be one in his future if he keeps doing what he's doing, but he's going to have to stay on the field to help his chances.
Yeah, that's a good point. If he, you know, logs 140, 45, 150 games, I believe he does win the award. But like you said, not playing a game after September 4th did hurt him. And Ender Inciarte takes it away from him here in 2016. Mark, now this is my final question, I promise, this time. With Thanksgiving coming up 8 days from now, obviously turkey is always the main attraction at the Thanksgiving table, but what for you personally is your favorite Thanksgiving fixin'?
Oh, my goodness. My wife does a really mean garlic mashed potato. It's got like it's like Yukon Gold potatoes and mash. It's got a hint of garlic in it, and I'm more excited about those potatoes than I am about the turkey. And she makes a magnificent turkey, so I'm thrilled for that. And I gorge myself. I always run this local 10K every year on Thanksgiving morning, so I'm always pretty hungry come dinner time. So I'm always very excited for Thanksgiving dinner, and I definitely eat as much as I can and get a food coma and then fall asleep watching TV.
But you balance things out, unlike most Americans who just wake up, watch football, eat, and then fall asleep. You at least do something active in the day, so you neutralize the Thanksgiving food effect, which is great. And I will say to you and Mrs. Sheldon, if there's any leftover potatoes, send them to 75 9th Avenue, New York, New York, courtesy of MLB.com. That would be great for all of us.
we'd be happy to, of course.
Awesome, awesome. Mark Sheldon, great stuff as always. A happy upcoming Thanksgiving to you and your family. We'll do this again soon. In the meantime, Matt Waymire signing off for MLB.com Extras, Cincinnati Reds. It is 8 days before Thanksgiving, and we're talking with Cubs reporter Kerry Muscat. And Kerry, for months and months, doing the podcast, that is how I would introduce you as Cubs reporter Kerry Muscat. But given the circumstances and the changing world that we now live in, I can say that you, Kerry Muscat, the reporter for the World Series champion Chicago Cubs, it is still hard to believe that I'm saying those words, and I'm sure it's somewhat surreal to, again, hear the words and see the words, and for you to type those words for Cubs.com. Is this whole thing still a little surreal to you, even a couple of weeks after the 108-year drought ended?
It's just been tough to kind of catch your breath after everything that happened. I think the thing that's been the most fun in the last couple of weeks has been talking to people who may not have necessarily been Cubs fans, but really got caught up in all the excitement in the neighborhood and in the city, and watch the final games and watch Game 7 and just how excited they were as to what was happening, and of course became instant experts on it naturally. But it was it's just been fun to hear from people who, one, from people who, you know, generations, you know, I wish my grandfather was here, I wish my father was here. I've heard a lot of that, but also just to hear people who may not have been fans but just got so excited about it and now know all the players by first name. And I mean, I've had people come up and say, boy, didn't Javi do great, this and this, and these people didn't even know who Javi was, you know, a few months ago. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah, it's been an amazing experience for Cubs Nation. Literally millions of people getting to celebrate something they never thought would occur in their lifetime. And, Kerry, for you personally, were you able at any point to separate yourself as a journalist and enjoy this simply as a fan, or has it been so crazy, so busy that you haven't had that opportunity to really do that yet?
To be honest, I've been pretty busy working. So no, it's been a lot of work. The team may be having an off season and the guys all may be home, but there's just been a lot of stuff to do in the wake of the championship. So no, everything's fine. Yeah, I did like sitting down with David Ross and having him tell me that his daughter wanted her own champagne party. So what they did was he went out and bought some cheap champagne and they sprayed it all over her and her friends in their backyard in Florida. She got goggles and her swimsuit on. So little things like that are kind of, that's a little more fun.
That's stuff you love to hear. Grandpa Rossi now riding off into the sunset, and what a way to cap a career, not only winning a World Series, but homering, for crying out loud, in Game 7 in the final game of your career. It could not have turned out better for David Ross, which brings us right into my next topic, is that, you know, watching the highlights of the parade, 5 million people in Chicago approximately to celebrate and revel in that entire thing. And for me, Kerry, one of the most poignant moments was Anthony Rizzo at the podium and, you know, choking up and getting teary-eyed talking about David Ross. I mean, it's no secret that he had such a big impact on this team, but to see that in that setting from Anthony Rizzo, I mean, talk about just how profoundly he is going to be missed next season.
Yeah, David will be missed, and I'm hoping he planned on talking to Theo Epstein after Thanksgiving about possibly coming back to the team in some kind of role. He could be, say, a special assistant to the GM or something like that, and be in spring training and contribute somehow. Ross's influence will definitely be missed, but I think that he did enough for these guys, and they'll remember, and I think he left a very good legacy here.
Yeah, he certainly did. He touched a lot of players, such a professional, such a personality, and that's somebody that you do not easily replace. He is going to be missed next year by the Cubs, that is for sure. And, of course, Kerry, the offseason slows down for nobody, especially you, as, like you said, you've been still just working like crazy since the Cubs won the World Series. And Dexter Fowler, for the second straight year, rejecting the qualifying offer from the club. And I got to think that we're not going to see a scene like we had last year in the waning days of spring training when his presence is announced by Joe Maddon and he surprises everybody. He's back with the team. Assuming that he is gone, what does the lineup look like at the top, and what does the outfield configuration look like with Fowler no longer there in center field?
Well, when they didn't think that Fowler was coming back this year, they were projecting Jason Hayward in center. So that's one of their options. Jed Hoyer, the general manager, was asked about Albert Elmora Jr. I don't think they think that Elmora is quite ready for the job full time, but he might break with the team, you know, and be used out there in center. He's a terrific defensive player. It's just a matter of, you know, whether or not he's ready offensively. I think the bigger gap with Fowler's absence will be who's going to lead off for the team. There really isn't an obvious choice. I know Maddon likes having Kyle Schwarber up high in the lineup, but I'm not sure he's a leadoff man. So that's something that'll have to be figured out.
And you mentioned Schwarber, of course, and I'm still in awe of what this guy did. I remember, you know, literally broadcasting a game here from Chelsea where he was playing in the Arizona Fall League, and, you know, he gets a double, he draws a walk, he looks good, but you're thinking there's no way he's going to be ready to face Corey Kluber in the World Series in, you know, 40, 45-degree weather. How in awe are you of what he did for this Cubs team in the Fall Classic? I can't get over it.
Well, actually, I'm not surprised at all. Knowing Kyle as I do, I kind of expected him to come back.
So. And be this productive?
Yeah. Just knowing Kyle, yeah, not surprised.
Yeah, I mean, that speaks to his character and his hard work that he was able to do this and provide such a huge boost for those four games in the American League ballpark as a DH and at full health next year. Look out, one more weapon for this very young, very talented championship Cubs team. And, Kerry, to begin to wrap up here, it's been a great offseason in terms of the awards for Cubs players. We've seen Anthony Rizzo already collect some hardware, both a Silver Slugger and a Gold Glove. And, of course, tonight on this Wednesday, we find out if either Kyle Hendricks or John Lester wins the Cy Young. We find out on Thursday if Chris Bryant takes home the MVP. Give me your predictions on all three of those guys.
Well, the Cy Young is actually pretty hard. I could see where a lot of voters might go for Max Scherzer. He's got 20 wins. There are a lot of people that seem to think that strikeouts are important. I have a tough time picking between Lester and Hendricks, but I do know that Kyle Hendricks, when the Cubs needed a big win and it was his start, he came through. And it was for a guy who started spring training not having a spot secured in the rotation, it was an amazing season. And to finish as the Major League ERA leader is just really impressive to me. So that just on that basis, you know, I'd lean more towards Hendricks. But on the other hand, Lester, 19 wins and had two remarkable months where he was unbeaten. And, you know, it's just really hard to pick between the two, which is why I'm worried that maybe Scherzer might get it. Just, you know, sort of the other two sort of knocked him out. So, but it'll be fun. Bryant, I think, is a no-brainer in terms of the MVP award, which would be even more impressive. Here's a guy who's gone from, you know, top collegiate player to top minor league player to top rookie of the year and then to MVP. That's I'm not sure what he can do for an encore. But, well, he's going to get married in January, so that's probably the encore. But he's had a pretty good run.
Yeah, I'll say, like you said, to go from rookie of the year to World Series champion to MVP to husband in less than 2 years, pretty darn impressive. We'll see what the voters say both tonight and tomorrow. And Kerry, before I let you go, I've been asking all of your NL Central colleagues a little Thanksgiving question as we're 8 days away. But turkey always the main attraction at the Thanksgiving table. That's undisputed. But in terms of a Thanksgiving fixin', what is your personal favorite?
I'm sorry, Thanksgiving. What was
a fixin', like stuffing, cranberry, something like that?
Oh, I'm renowned in my family for my stuffing.
Okay, very nice, very nice. I'm a stuffing guy too. Pretty much anything you put on the table, I will eat. And Kerry, I hope that things slow down for you. You can enjoy Thanksgiving a little over a week from now, and we'll do this again somewhere close to the winter meetings, I project. In the meantime, great stuff as always. We appreciate it. Kerry Muscat joining us here on this Wednesday. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Chicago Cubs.
MLB.TV Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.TV Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go. Every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.TV for details.